Wally, your reasoning here makes a lot of sense to me. But that means you're going to arrive, as you said, with like 20 minutes of fuel. Not technically a violation of the regulations, given this is VFR, but certainly a violation of the spirit of the regulations. Is this an emergency? A pilot is over an airport with an hour of fuel. Are you really dipping into PIC authority in an emergency here to make this happen? Explain to me.
Absolutely. This pilot is down to one more decision. And if he doesn't make that decision correctly, he's very likely to have a bad outcome to this flight. So yes, it's certainly he's safe at flying at the moment. He's not losing control of his airplane, but he's losing control of his decisions. And the next decision he makes needs to be correct. And if it's not, he's probably going to have a big problem.
Dave.
He's down to one decision because he's already made two horrendous decisions. If I was in his situation, I could just imagine thinking that that expensive fuel at St. Cloud is looking like a really great deal now. You know, I mean, it would provide options. And secondly, his choice to pass up Ontonagon, even you know, the place where it was windy but down the runway, another really boneheaded choice. Now he's down to playing his last card. And I think that his best option is landing at his current location because diverting now, he's got some faith in his fuel computer. I don't. You know, it would be easy to unport a fuel tank in this turbulence. He may not realize it, but he's played his last card. He's got to land at his current location.
Let me stay with you for just a second, Dave. And you pulled out a couple things that I think are really interesting about this flight, and he made two bad decisions. But in the moment, they seemed like very reasonable decisions. We tell people, you know, go around if the weather is rough. And he made a plan such that he ended up at an airport with an hour of gas. I mean, that's regularly we say, hey, you know, you should plan to land VFR with an hour of gas. Where was the flaw in the planning of this flight? You made some bad decisions. Or was it that the flight planning was fine? It wasn't flawed. It was the decision-making that was flawed.
I think the decision-making was flawed. If he would have taken off with more fuel, he would have had more options. And then bypassing his best option, Ontonagon, when he got there, in favor of a place with more wind and a worse runway alignment, you know, highly questionable decisions.
Richard.
Yeah, so I agree with Dave. I would stay where he is for a couple of reasons. One, having the faith in the accuracy of that totalizer is something you're talking about. You're going to divert down to where that totalizer is reading single digit gallons now. That's going to be the most uncomfortable hour you've flown in quite a while, staring at the fuel gauge, hoping it doesn't drop more, hoping it was right in all your calculations. I wouldn't cut it that close. And the other thing I would say, if I were an instructor sitting on this guy's shoulder, I would say, dude, take control of this situation. He's let himself get rattled by the winds, and now he's questioning his thinking, he's questioning his skills. Get control of this airplane and stop letting the wind push you around. You should have landed at Houghton. Now you should be able to put this thing down at this place.
JP.
You know, the forecast winds, not a surprise, and it's clear that this pilot, from these two decisions of not being able to land, even at an airport where the wind is aligned down the runway, is not comfortable with wind. And I think the bad decision-making begins with launching into this, knowing that you got some pretty gusty conditions there. Now that you're in this, you've already tried at one airport, and you didn't feel good about it. You go to another airport, it's worse. You're in a situation where you need to try to find a guarantee. And the guarantee is Land O'Lakes, or as close as you can get as far as trying to land this airplane. So that's why I'm going there. Ontonagon would have been the ideal choice. I don't know why a go-around was executed there just because it was bumpy on final. You knew it was windy going into it. But right now, you are in a place where you have got to make a decision. You don't have a whole lot of time. So whatever you do, you can't botch it. Otherwise, you've turned it into a glider.
Well, let me come back to you on that a little bit. You're saying, why did he make a go around? But we around this table many, many times have said, if you don't like it, go around. This pilot was at 400 AGL. The plane was rocking back and forth. There was still fuel on board, you know, and the pilot went around. Are you saying that was a bad decision, or are you saying, yeah, that go around was fine, but you should have come back and tried it again?
That's what I would have done, because it is aligned with the runway. And the other thing about it is, I'm not quite sure if you, if I were on this flight, I would have looked at the surrounding airports and I would have seen what's around the coastal area there is a worse option. So this is my best option at the time. I probably would have done that again, even though it's bumpy on final and everything. It is aligned with the runway before I get myself in this situation where, man, I got to do this or I'm going to be out of gas. I mean, we are backed in a corner almost at this point.
Tom.
Well, I'm concerned. First off, I'm inclined to go to K.I. Sawyer. Maybe it's an old Air Force thing or whatever, but the main reason that I like that as an alternate is it has a very long, wide runway. It's an old bomber base, and so it gives me a lot more room to maneuver in the wind. The wind is almost right down the runway there, and it's only gusting to 15, which is not all that much. But an important point about the fuel state in this, and it might radically change my decision. Maybe he has well-tested and appropriate faith in the totalizer. But this is a type of airplane where you have to switch from one tank to another. And the totalizer will tell you how much fuel is on board, but it doesn't tell you where that fuel is. If he has put himself in a state where he has a small amount of fuel in both tanks, in other words, he's got an hour of fuel left, but it's split between the two tanks, that's a radically different situation than having one tank almost empty and the other ones still have almost an hour of fuel on board. I don't want to show up somewhere, you know, be over the Great North Woods there somewhere, or even show up in the pattern at Sawyer at a point where I've got very little fuel in either tank, and then I get myself into a real problem with possible fuel onboarding.
So Tom, let me stay with you for a second. You're going down to Sawyer. What is your fuel management strategy for that? Let's suppose worst case, you've got half and half at this point. Are you going to run one dry up top? Are you going to run to a stumble? Or how are you going to put you're going to Sawyer, so how are you basketing your eggs there, if you will?
I am not a fan of running a tank completely dry. I've just done some significant research into fuel starvation accidents and found that they don't always restart. At least that's what happens in the NTSB report. So I'm not a fan of running it completely dry. My plan would have been to have shown up to Houghton in the first case with almost all of my reserve fuel in a single tank, so I can divert if I need to on a single tank without having to worry about that.
John.
So my choice was one more try and then off to Land O'Lakes. But I would slow down, take advantage of the tailwind. Power charts show at 55% power, you're down to 6.5 gallons an hour, 93 knots airspeed with the tailwind, 110 knot ground speed, you'd be there in less than 30 minutes, 3 gallons or so to get there. I'd be really concerned about that fuel totalizer also. It's because fuel totalizers are really good at the burn rate, but it's a computer and it's garbage in, garbage out. You know, did you really have 35 gallons? I would give it one more shot. The wind was variable enough in the first time around, was a lot closer to the runway center line. One other thing that really struck me at this, and it always does in these situations, is how much time it took to go through analyzing all this data, looking up the charts, the performance charts, looking at the wind at, you know, 5 or 6 different airports around there and stuff, and then think about, you know, single pilot bouncing around, knocking his head on the ceiling, trying to make a decision here. It would be very easy to get overwhelmed. And I think that Dave talked about the need to pre-plan this. You know, every time we went further on to this, we threw away a few more cards. And we didn't have enough cards in the deck to start with.
And I like your idea. You sort of hinted at it there, like to figure out how much you can pull this power back and what that setting would be. You're burning time, figuring that out in a stressful situation. If you had that preset on a card or something, this is my gotta reach long legs emergency fuel setting. I'm going there and I'm going inland. Like, that would make a lot of sense. Dave, you had a comment in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to address your point about the go around. And I do not fault the pilot for going around at Ontonagon the first time, but it's go around, not go away. You know, he go around, take another try. You've got plenty of fuel. You don't need to go away and throw away your best option.
Wally.
Well, I just want to make a comment about Dave's comments about bad decisions. And clearly in Monday morning quarterbacking, we can all see this pilot made some bad decisions. But I found myself in a similar situation one time. Bad decisions, but motivated with trying to get the job done. Many years ago, doing a training flight in an airliner airplane, we were unable to get fuel at the airport we departed from. My plan was to go to a nearby airport, do a couple of touch-and-goes, and we'll get fuel there. As we arrived there, we learned that fuel was not going to be available there. So now it's time to return to the original airport where the airline needed the airplane to cover a passenger flight the next day. And I found myself with about 15 minutes of fuel on about a 4-mile final, catching up to another airplane. And that's when I suddenly realized that whole series of bad decisions, I was trying to get the job done. I was trying to get the training done. But I let myself get sucked in and sucked in. And I was in a position where there was not going to be a go-around. And we talked about that as a crew. I said, we're just going to land behind this guy because we're not going to go around. So I can see how this poor pilot got there.
Yeah, I could see you watching your whole career flash before your eyes in that situation right there. What incredible stress of bringing this in. Richard.
Yeah, something to consider here is both these runways, either Ontonagon, where he went around the first time, and Houghton are 3,000, 3,500 feet, something like that. And what does an archer or an arrow take? 1,000 feet, maybe, you know, to land
and roll out.
Yeah. You know, you've got a lot of runway to get the aircraft down and stabilized and work your controls and get a handle on this wind and stop letting it push you around. So you can come down to your typical landing spot, you know, 500,000 feet down, and just work the airplane till you feel like you got control of it. You got probably 2,000 feet to work with to get the airplane down on the runway. I would use the runway length available to you there.
John.
Yeah, to that though, Ontonagon, you look at it as there's lots of trees, lots of mechanical turbulence there, which is why it got so bad the first time around. I'm not sure I'd try that again with the wrestling match. If anything, Houghton would be the place. It's a little more open. But I agree with you that, you know, sooner or later, especially Cherokee's low wing airplanes are generally pretty easy, or easier than it would be in a Skyhawk to wrestle it to the ground, you know. So that would be my choice again, to go for number one, to land where we are.
I'm sure this pilot would happily just sort of hand you the yoke at this point. Easy to wrestle to the ground, John. Tom.
Well, I was thinking the same thing, that at Ontonagon, anyhow, the go-around decision was made at about 400 feet above ground level. And, you know, we want to be in a stabilized approach, as we say. If this had gone badly, if he had continued that landing and had gone off the runway or something, we'd be having this discussion about stabilized approaches and why he didn't do a stabilized approach. But the point here is that often the winds will decrease somewhat in speed and even change slightly in direction. As you get closer to the ground, the stronger the wind is, the more of a directional change you might often have closer to the ground. It might be that if he were to continue to 200 feet, he may have been able to get back in alignment. I am in favor of diverting down to Sawyer, but I'd give it one more try too, especially knowing that I'm going to have a significant tailwind headed back down toward the southeast there, based on what we've seen here. And as John said, you can slow down, you can reduce power to go at even more economical power setting on the way down.
So the one more try is kind of an interesting thing, because every try you do, you're eating into that reserve. But you were convinced, Tom, to like maybe give it one more try just because of the variability of things?
The variability of things and the fact that the not only over time between the time now and the time you make the next attempt, but also over altitude. It might get a little bit better as you get just a little bit closer to the ground. Give it one more try. And then assuming that the fuel was distributed in what I would say is an appropriate way in the tank system, at that point, you'd still have the opportunity to go to an alternate.
JP.
Yeah, and that was something I was going to mention. I think, you know, playing a Monday morning quarterback here, I think the big issue was on that first attempt, I think the pilot bailed a little too early, because the lower you get, you're going to have the influences of buildings or a tree line or something where you may be dealing with some higher winds there at 400 AGL, but you get on down a little bit more and you're going to see things relax. And there would have still been ample time for a go around there. So I think the first landing attempt would have been the one that would probably have worked. And I will caution, just from prior experience, I remember being about a 50-hour pilot, and it was a day where the wind had picked up. I knew it was going to be windy, but it was a lot windier than what I had imagined. So I get to an airport that I'm my home airport, and first landing attempt, it's a go-around. I didn't have the fuel issue. I had plenty of gas. Tried it again. Go-around. Third time, I'm like, I'm landing this airplane. Emotionally, I'm there. I'm going to land this airplane. And I just about broke that airplane. And I learned from that, it's like, don't force it. If it's not going to work, don't do it. And I found an airport where the wind was more aligned with the runway, and it worked out just fine.
I feel like all of us have been there to one degree. Yeah, there are nods all around the table. Like, we're all talking quickly. This is a high-tension experience that people recognize for real. And this pilot has to, like, as you said, Richard, like, take command. How do you do that emotionally, especially knowing that if you keep trying to land, you're throwing away your chance to go elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. We had a guy on our podcast that had an issue with his airplane, and he talked about it so well. He said, you know, I was just letting the scenario get away from me. And finally, I said to myself, this is the guy on our podcast talking, hey, where is that cocky guy, that arrogant guy? I need him in the seat right now, right? And I thought that was a really good way to put it. That's how he sort of got himself in the mindset of, I need to take control of this situation better than what I'm doing now. So maybe that's a way to think about it.
Yeah, you actually call on a little bit of macho. Like, yeah. This is the time to come up with a dangerous attitude and use it to your advantage. Tom.
Well, you know, confidence comes from practiced ability. And, you know, we should all be practicing in crosswinds. We should all have a pretty good idea going in what our personal limit is and the type of airplane we're flying. And if he had, you know, had not been consciously thinking about what is the greatest crosswind I've landed in most recently, am I consistently landing the airplane with the runway stripe between the main wheels? In other words, am I very good at directional control? Then you might be in a very tense situation here. If you know, okay, I do that. I touch down on speed in alignment with the runway, you know, with the airplane, with no sideways drift all of the time. I can do that because I have done that recently. Then you can say, okay, take a breath. I've got this. It's the pilot that doesn't really have a good idea of how wide their, how expansive their envelope is, their personal envelope is, that's going to get into a lot of trouble in this sort of situation.
Wally.
Well, our pilot has about 150 hours. So I don't know if he ever had that cocky guy in the cockpit, Richard, but I think he very well could have. But the other interesting thing is here, he's encountering a whole new set of meteorological data that he has never encountered before with these gusty winds along the lake. And he may or may not really realize that getting inland will make those go away, which is really what's causing him his trouble. And if he had understood that, on his next trip, he's going to plan this trip a whole lot different, I'll bet, because he's learned a lesson here.
Even though you had the fuel to continue all the way to Houghton to turn towards Land O'Lakes when you bailed like at Ironwood, back there. That might have been a good choice.
Had he had previous
wind is the issue.
Had he had previous experience flying along this lakeshore under these conditions, he may have made that good decision back there. Right.
Richard.
Jeff, I want to go back to a discussion you guys were having on fuel balance, because I think it's really important. At some point when you decide to make that diversion, and we've all probably been there where you're going to cut your fuel closer than makes you comfortable, your priority is no longer fuel balance. Now your priority is usable fuel. So making sure you manage those tanks like you guys were talking about to emphasize the usable fuel. So you're going to use every bit of fuel you can out of one. You don't care about balance anymore because you're low enough to where you're well within those limits. So managing that fuel properly so you get the most usability is really critical. You guys mentioned that earlier. I just thought it was important to emphasize.
Yeah, absolutely. The fuel management is something I think that's not talked about enough, particularly when people are switching from one airplane to another, right? This pilot learned to fly on a 152 and never had to worry about it particularly, right? And then they went and got a Warrior and suddenly had left-right tanks that they had to deal with and manage that fuel. Let's suppose this pilot bought a 172 instead. Dave, you had brought up unporting fuel in the turbulence and the turns. Would you apply fuel management there where you were pulling from both and actually try and shunt things over to one side? You're supposed to land and take off on both, but this is an emergency. Would you worry about that at all or just in a low-wing airplane?
You know, I actually like the low-wing better in this scenario because I can hoard all the fuel in one place. And if you've got an airplane that operates off both tanks, man, when it's out of gas, it's out of gas completely. So when it goes quiet, you've played your last card there. You know, the really interesting part of this discussion to me is Richard's point about the mindset. You know, it's true, and Wally was saying 150-hour pilot, remember that. He's not got a huge amount of experience. But I think it's fair in this pilot situation to draw upon things that are even outside aviation. You know, I mean, you come from a long line of people that have obviously survived to procreate to get you into this 21st century. You know, I mean, you've got survival instincts. You've got life experiences that where you've had to call upon some self-discipline and some inner toughness. And it's like, yeah, just getting in touch with that, make this landing, and then nothing succeeds like success. You know, if you succeed in this, then it'll be a good learning point and something to talk about later. But it's, you know, just focus on the task at hand, landing the plane at this airport.
Let me stay with you for a second there, Dave. How much does the airplane itself matter here? We're talking about a Warrior, a stout trainer that can take a lot of abuse, that could take touching down with a serious side load and probably not fold up. And if it did fold it up, like, you're probably getting out of it anyway. Because once you stay, your decision one, you are putting this airplane on the ground at Houghton. There is nowhere else to go. Does that cross your mind at all?
You know, it's not to a huge extent, but just a really quick anecdote was I once flew with a guy, a very accomplished pilot who had flown all sorts of really demanding airplanes. I was shocked, really, that his incredibly poor stick and rudder technique. And it's like, man, this guy's got hands of stone. I mean, it's like he's he's got elephant feet. You know, I mean, he's, from a technique standpoint, the guy was really terrible. But the one thing that he had in abundance was this sort of, this chip on his shoulder, this sort of, this vulgar Irish sort of attitude that it's like, he is not going to get pushed around. And when the wind pushes against him, he is going to use whatever he's got at his disposal to fight back. And he'd stick his chin out and he would scrap. I mean, he was a scrapper. And I just thought, wow, you know, that is the essential element of success in flying. It's this scrappy attitude. It's not finesse or technique. It's this attitude that it's like, you are not going to get pushed around. You are going to command this airplane to touch down where you want it, and you're going to hold the center line. And it was that served him so well throughout a long career of flying.
But such a fine line between the scrappy attitude that puts it down in the center line and the scrappy attitude that puts it down in the grass and creates scrap. like scrap metal, you know, left over.
To me, that was the just the total takeaway was that it's like his scrappy attitude. He's a fighter, and it's like when you get in backed in a corner like this pilot is here now, it's like he needs some fight.
Tom.
Well, yeah, I agree. You absolutely, and I was going to use the word command. I like to use that word a lot. That you take command or you reacquire or you retake command because he'd lost it basically of what's going on here. I just want to be, I would be very cautious about trying to do it on attitude alone. We talk about that a lot. We've all flown with pilots that had a better idea or a better impression of their abilities than they really had. So it really comes down to, I think, how well you have flown the airplane in the past and tell yourself, it's time for me to fly it as well as I ever had. If it doesn't work out, I mean, we talk about, you know, well, if it ends up in a ball somewhere, well, that's a big problem. And I don't want that to happen because I thought I could do it, but I really didn't have the skills to do it. At 150 total hours, yes, they have certain command skills, but part of those command skills have to be decision-making, and a lot of the decision-making happened long before he ever got to Houghton.
I think that distinction is confidence versus arrogance. I like flying with confident pilots. I don't like flying with unconfident pilots, you know, the kind that are kind of the wilting flowers and have tough times making a decision. Those guys scare me. I want somebody to be confident, but I don't want them to be arrogant. That, to me, is the distinction I look for.
Let me ask one more question on the situation itself, especially for those of you who are staying. How much does the variability of the wind matter? Would you do a couple circuits waiting for a better alignment on that kind of wind? Or are you just like, what it is in the flare is what it is in the flare. I'm just going to keep trying again and again and again. Because you're the only one at this airport. You could position yourself over final if you wanted to. JP.
You could. And I think that would be something that you could probably do and experiment with if you had the luxury of having the gas for that. You know, I would hate to be the person up there holding out for the wind to change and burning fuel and burning through what limited options I already have. But I think, as everybody's really said, a Piper Warrior is a very tolerant airplane, even of poor technique. I think it would be easy enough to get this airplane on the ground with a couple of attempts here if the pilot would be committed to this and control the airplane. I mean, maybe it's not exactly on center line, but it's on the pavement and stopped and safely to the FBO.
You know, this reads like so many NTSB reports, especially the fact that there was a series of decisions, all of which had some validity in the moment. And were they isolated, would have been just a good story. And now they've added up in such a way that this pilot is in an emergency situation. The plan initially wasn't flawed. And anyone who's heard me talking before has heard me say, I hate the saying to plan the flight and fly the plan. You plan the flight and then you fly the flight because it never goes exactly as planned. But at the same time, this scenario points out you've made the plan for a reason. And you can change the plan, but you can't forget the reason. You're going to want to arrive there with some extra fuel. You can't forget about that.